All right, everybody, welcome. It's 2026, and we are back. Jay Flemma Sports Report on Golf News Net and iHeartRadio. And I am Jay Flemma. It's nice to have all of you back. Thanks for a great year last year. We had so much fun. It was a Ryder Cup year. We had two trips to England. We covered the first Open Championship from over there. It was a phenomenal major championship season, and we're going to set the table for this coming year. But before we do that, very quickly, congratulations to the Patriots and the Seahawks. We'll be playing in the Super Bowl. Not particularly my favorite teams, but it should be an interesting game, especially with the storyline of Seahawks want revenge for Malcolm Butler. It's kind of funny, actually. One of my very favorite people in sports is a fellow by the name of Hank Gola. I remember one year years ago was when Pittsburgh and Green Bay went to the Super Bowl before the season started. Before the season started, Hank Gola went all the way through all of the games in the season for the Daily News, and he did all of the playoffs and the Super Bowl. And he came up with Green Bay 31, Pittsburgh 24. And for those of you who remember, especially us Steeler fans who still grouse about it to this day, the score was 31 to 25. Apparently, poor Hank forgot the 2-point conversion the Steelers would have had to go for coming from behind. And so here he is to make up for that one little gaffe in an otherwise pristine preseason Super Bowl pick to talk to us about his latest book, which has been racing up the sports book charts like a bullet by its name, a hit record. It's called Ryder Cup Rivals. Here is Hank Gola, ex-Daily News, and one of the true greats of golf writing and sports writing in general. Hank, welcome back to the show. You're our first guest of the year.
Wow. Do I get a free gift for that or something?
Yes, you do. You get a bottle of hot sauce. Okay, you get a
All
bottle of JB's best hot sauce. Why is
right.
it the
Okay.
best? Because it's the tastiest, it's the most savory, it's the spiciest. When it says JB's, it's the best.
All
And it's
right.
a Golf Writers by John Burwa, formerly PGA.com.
All right, send it over.
Yeah, now he peddles Tabasco. Okay, well, it's actually way better than Tabasco, and it's way better than that Frank's too. But I'll tell you, the only thing that's better than that right now is I am absolutely stunned by not only the terrific prose in Ryder Cup Rivals that puts us right smack into the middle of the gallery where we can smell the grass and we can hear the thud of the club as it spanks the golf ball, you know, and we can feel every bit of emotion throughout the century plus. And on top of that, the exhaustive amount of research that you put into this book, tell us a little bit about what the ride has been like since you released the book and, you know, the wonderful wave of acclaim that you've been on with it.
Well, it's gotten very good reviews. I'm very grateful for that. I would have liked to see the problem was the Ryder Cup was an absolute dud, if you're from the United States.
It was
And
worse than
we
a
were
dud.
hoping
We'll
to,
talk about that, but
yeah. Well, we were hoping to ride a little bit of a wave of momentum after that, and that didn't occur. So yeah, we sold a lot more books before the Ryder Cup than after the Ryder Cup. So, but I'm very proud of it. It's a good book. I put a lot of work into it, a lot of research, and before the Ryder Cup, it was getting a lot of praise as this is the one book you need to read as kind of a primer for the Ryder Cup. So, again, I wish it would have been a better Ryder Cup, but we've got a little momentum out of that, but we didn't. So we're just kind of moving along right now.
it really is almost a textbook for a college course in the history of the Ryder Cup, though, because you exhaustively go through so many critical chapters and critical moments in the history of the Ryder Cup. So, since you've written it, you tell us What would you say are the single most important mile markers in the career arc of the Ryder Cup?
Well, kind of, I mean, that's what the book is all about, the mile markers, as you put it. I picked out 13. I don't know why I picked out 13. We could have picked out a little more, but the book was getting a little long, so I didn't want to go to 15 because we were repeating certain themes. But each of these Ryder Cups kind of denotes a turning point or just an important time period in the evolution of the Ryder Cup. So, I mean, obviously we start with the first one in 27, and then we move along. And so you got 37 in there, which was the first one on foreign soil. You got 47 in there, which, although it was an American blowout, it was the first one after World War II. And it kind of set the stage for the next 20 years when the US was a dominant force and forced in the inclusion of the continent, European continent. So, and then it goes on from there. But each one of these was kind of a momentous turn in the Ryder Cup. And we go all the way up to 2016. I know it was the last one in the book. I know there have been a bunch of them since, but 2016 was coming after the task force. And obviously the United States had to make a stand there, and they did. And of course, now all the task force is pretty much whatever they did is pretty much forgotten because it's kind of fallen apart again, and the U.S. can't even win on home soil anymore. So it's if you're an American golf fan, it's a little depressing what's going on.
Let's walk through a couple of those. Since I just came back from two England trips, and one of the places that I fell in love with was Southport and Ainsdale. You mentioned that. That was the host of the 1937 Ryder Cup, the
Yeah.
fourth one in history, but that was the first time that the USA had defeated England on British soil. Tell us
Right.
a little bit about that tournament.
Right. Well, actually, it was the first time either side had won on foreign soil. But 37 was interesting because you had as Ryder Cup rookies, you had Snead, Nelson, and then Ralph Gildo, who was the US Open champion. Hogan wasn't on that team because Hogan kind of blossomed a little later than Snead and Nelson did. But Gildo was the kind of the third member of the triumvirate at the time. And basically they went over there and they took the British team apart. And it was kind of an awakening of that kind of noticed that the United States was developing players kind of at a more rapid clip than they were over in the UK. And you had Snead and Nelson, absolute superstars. The guy that kind of led the charge for the Brits was Henry Cotton, who was a really good player and a Hall of Famer and everything else. But beyond Henry, it was kind of like pretty much a mismatch. And the Brits were counting on the conditions at SNA, and they were hoping for the wind to blow and everything else. And the fact that the Americans had not played under those conditions, not only just the conditions, the wind and such, but just the course conditions. Links golf, of course, is different than the golf that they were playing in the U.S., and it took a little bit of different strategy. But the Americans kind of adapted pretty quickly and ended up winning that. There wasn't a blowout, but they won it pretty handily. And actually, the funny thing about the 37 Ryder Cup, it was the first time that teams complained about crowd behavior. And the Americans felt that they were getting a little bit of a rough going from the British fans, and actually complained about it afterwards after they landed in the US. It created a little bit of a firestorm. But it was kind of the first time that, and the first of it led to, it was the first of many sort of crowd controversies that would come after it. That was the start of it all.
Now, I've had the good fortune to play SNA, as it's called, so I've seen exactly how quirky, and it's quirky interesting, but how quirky it is. And that is one course that has not had a lot of changes to it since 1937. It's remained very much authentic to its roots. And so, one of the reasons why the Brits were heavily favored, besides that it was thought that they still had a superior team, was that A, the weather, it was going to be very windy, and B, the golf course was completely, pardon the pun, foreign metaphorically in style to the American players. However, they were led by Walter Hagen, who won two open championships.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, well, I mean, I write a lot about Walter and how he kind of led the charge for the professional golfer over the amateur and basically changed. I mean, look, we remember Walter at Royal Cinque Ports in the Open, where because of the different status of the amateur and the professional, they forced the professional golfers who were entered into that open to dress in the pro shop with using one sharing one hook. Walter rented a limo. I think it was a Daimler Benz, if I remember correctly. It's in my book, but parked it in front of the clubhouse, and that's where he did his he changed into his shoes. So it was quite the character, and
But when he
he was
won at
mesmerizing. The British press loved him.
when he won at Hoylake, he had the audacity to bring his wife into the clubhouse to celebrate, which was a big no-no back then.
He pushed every envelope there was. So but in 37 he was the American captain. It was the last time he was the American captain. He had been the American captain since it's the inception of the Ryder Cup in 27, and even before at the 26. They played against each other in 26, and the Brits would like to say that that was a Ryder that should have been the first Ryder Cup because I think it was 11. Anyway, the score was ridiculous. Again, the Americans didn't have their best team over there. What would happen? The Ryder Cup would always be staged before the Open Championship because the Americans only went over there to play for in the Open. Making the trip over there meant that that late they would play in the Ryder Cup and then play in the Open Championship. Kind of that's what got all the Americans over there. But in 26, when they had this kind of what be, was kind of an unofficial Ryder Cup, I guess you would call it, the cup wasn't actually awarded that year.
It was a
There
pre-contest.
was a general strike in Great Britain in the UK, and that prevented a lot of American golf, like the Sarrazin and some of the big names, from going over there. And Hagen, who was still the captain of the U.S. contingent, I mean, he had a bunch of players who would never have qualified. He had a trick shot artist on his team just to just to amplify the team that he brought over there,
Now,
and they got thrashed pretty roundly, and
interestingly, 26 was the year Bobby Jones won the Open at Royal
yeah,
Liver.
but Bobby Jones wasn't eligible for the Ryder Cup because he wasn't a professional.
That's right, but I'm just saying that later on he would become a Brit killer. But that happened to be the year that he went over and he won his first of, I believe it was, didn't he win three Open Championships? Okay, he won again in 30 at Royal Liverpool, and then again in, oh, Jay, come on now, you know this.
I know this. You're the trivia guy, so
It'll come to me, but
I'm sure it will.
so let's jump now. We're talking with Hank Gola about his wonderful book, Ryder Cup Rivals, which you must go out and buy. It is an absolute imperative, whether you are a fan who wants to get the inside scoop on all the news and all the dirt and all of the fascinating, glowing stories as well, or whether you're a golf writer who needs the book to research everything you need to know about all the important Ryder Cups. So let's jump now to another
But
one.
mention Hagen. I got one story about Hagen that I didn't write about the 33 Ryder Cup, which was also at SNA. But that's where Denny Shute missed a putt on the 18th green, and it ended up handing the cup to the UK or the Brits. But Hagen was in the clubhouse at the time, entertaining the Prince of Wales, who would later abdicate the throne, was unable to go out and relay the situation to Denny Shute. So he watched it from the big picture window at SNA, and Shute kind of screwed it up, not knowing the situation, and the Brits ended up winning the Ryder Cup that year.
Well,
So he
that's
came
the
back
only time.
for his last go round as captain.
Well, that's not the only time that the Prince of Wales screwed up an important golfer that was from America. Never forget, in 1970, after two rounds, Lee Trevino was leading the Open Championship at St. Andrews. And in the clubhouse before the third round, he walks up to Prince Charles, now King Charles, and goes, "Hey, you ever shake hands with a Mexican?" And then the next thing you know, at the fifth hole, "Oh, dang it, I hit it at the wrong flag, and I'm stupid enough to hit it at the wrong flag." And he fell out of the lead, and Nicklaus ended up beating Doug Sanders in the playoff. So I don't know. I think that position of Prince of Wales might be a bit of a, you don't want to hang out with that guy until after you come back with a claret jug. But let's get back to S and A. Tell us a little bit about, there's some wonderful quirks to that golf course. For example, that 16th hole with that bunker that's Brobdingnagian in size and has all of those wooden planks blocking it. And if you don't get out of it, you're going to get a 9 or a 10 on that par 5.
The Americans got around all that because they pretty much overpowered that golf course. Snead could hit it a ton, Nelson too, and they kind of got around the quirks of it all by just going out there and hitting it longer than the Brits did. They were also kind of a little more advanced with their equipment. So they were able to take the quirks out of the equation, so to speak, and play golf as if it was back in the US.
All right, now let's jump. You said another one of the important mile markers, and I have to agree, was the addition of the Europeans. When we talk about the addition of the Europeans, the name that still burns like a proprietary torch is that of Seve Ballesteros. Tell us your favorite stories of the rise of the Europeans.
I mean, well, Seve was a force of nature, and they still rely on his memory every time they play the Ryder Cup. I mean, he was on their sleeves and everything else, and basically he just changed the fortunes of the European team by just his presence. And of course, I do write about the Ryder Cup at Valderrama, where he was the captain and seemed to be omnipresent. I mean, everywhere. In fact, he was actually annoying to some of the players. Like Monty said, "I don't need you." He was just everywhere. Came up to Monty, and Monty basically said, "Hey, look, just go away. I don't need you looking over my shoulder for on this shot." But
Who was it
he
that tried to get in his head by not giving him a fair drop? And Seve goes,
well, that was
"Look at
Zinger,
you.
Zinger, Zinger, and
Yeah,
and
Zinger, you want to play like this? We could play like this." That was his
yeah.
reaction.
Yeah, no, they were going at it tooth and nail, there was a controversy about a scuffed ball and whether Seve could play take it out of play.
The European rule versus the American rule.
Right. So yeah, but Zinger was as much of a competitor as Seve was. I mean, in this book, certain guys stand out as just Ryder Cup players, and that would include, of course, Seve, who won a share of majors, one of the all-time greats. But it will also include a guy like Lanny Watkins, who you wouldn't put up there in the pantheon. Excellent player, obviously, Hall of Famer as well. But he was just made. He was just one of those guys that was born to play in the Ryder Cup. And then on the European side, you had Seve. You had a guy like Bernhard Langer, Sandy Lyle, Nick Faldo. Those guys were all just Ryder Cup heroes. And
Bolden.
look at Monty. Monty never won a major, but man, I mean, was there ever a better Ryder Cup player than Monty?
Well, Ian
So,
Poulter.
Ian Poulter, same way. Yeah, never won a major, but he was a Ryder Cup stud. And it just seemed that the Europeans had a lot more of those guys than the Americans did. I did mention Watkins. There were a couple of other ones who were really outstanding, clutch players who would come through, but Not as many as the Europeans did. Seve was the guy, Seve didn't want to play in the Ryder Cup because, he had his own feud with the British PGA and the European Tour, about basically how many games, how many tournaments he
Yeah,
could
and each
play.
tour, exactly.
So, and he felt that he was kind of mistreated by the Ryder Cup, the Euro Ryder Cup nabobs, and they had to talk him back into playing for Europeans, and along with Tony Jacklin, bringing Tony Jacklin back as a captain and having Seve as the kind of the talisman, as they say over there. And it worked out. They said they were going to improve the conditions. I mean, look, could you imagine? Go back to Tony Jacklin, right? In 85, he was the captain of the 85 team. But he had played for the Brits earlier, and he insisted on first-class treatment. He says, if we're going to be any good, we got to get the same kind of treatment that the US gives their players. And that included, flying over on the Concorde and just better. I mean, Tony Jacklin played in one Ryder Cup where they issued plastic shoes, and his shoes actually fell apart going around, because they were made of plastic. So he made a point of saying, look, we're going to get the best there is, otherwise I'm not going to be the captain. And I would say that Tony as a captain, and Seve as the number one player, turned that around. And once Europe got involved, that they basically took over the Ryder Cup with their win at 85, and then following it up with a win in 87 at Memorial, beating on Jack Nicklaus's course with Jack Nicklaus's cap.
Now, when you mention Jacklin and you happen to mention Jack Nicklaus, we also bring up one of the greatest acts of sportsmanship at any time. We talk about the concession. Sadly, since the concession, there's been a lot of trouble at the Ryder Cup. There was poor sportsmanship in 99. There's been a lot of acrimony since then. There was absolute ugliness at Bethpage this year. Has the Ryder Cup lost its soul because of corporatism or television?
I don't know. I don't think the players themselves think about that at all. I just think that it's got carried away. I mean, look, they knew. Speaking of this year at Bethpage, I was there. I saw it. It was ugly, and it should have been nipped in the bud by the PGA of America, and they dropped the ball on that one. I mean, the Euros took control of that tournament on the first day. Basically, the crowd was just dead. And what that did was that amplified the voices of the idiots in the crowd. And you could pick them out pretty quickly. I mean, I could. I mean, you just, oh, that guy, that's the guy there. He said this, he's that guy there. And instead of kicking these people off the premises, they did nothing.
They
And
almost
then,
encouraged it by their silence.
yeah, and then they make it even worse by bringing out the, whatever woman she was, I don't know. Was she a woman comedian or something? They hired someone to pep up the crowd on the first tee because they had decided that, look, we've got to get the crowds going. The only way we're going to get back into this is if we get the crowds on our side, and they become New York fans, and we rally behind them, and they get us going. So she starts to get them going on the first tee, and she's encouraging these vulgar chants, like F you, Rory, and all of this stuff. It was absurd.
Yep,
And
I heard that. I heard that through the broadcast for the journalists, not the broadcast for NBC. We had a different feed, and our feed, I heard every word because I was not on a 13-second delay.
But it was ridiculous. But I wouldn't say that's for corporatism or TV. I mean, the PGA just let it get out of control. And you know what fans are going to be like. Look, in Brookline in 99, when the Euros were so outraged about the conduct of the American fans, you knew what Boston fans were going to be like. And Mark James, I even said it back then in 1999. If Mark James wanted, he had his team totally unprepared for that onslaught. He did. Now that they were much better prepared for this at Betpage, the Euros were. They knew what it was going to be like, and they were ready for it. But at Boston, what he should have done is take his team and put them in the bleachers at Fenway Park when the Yankees were in town, and said, "This is what you're going to get. This is the treatment that you're going to get." You just had to be more prepared for it than you were. And that's, like I mentioned, 37 was, the first bad behavior by the fans. But, it's just fans are that way. They get to be a little nationalistic, and that's how it goes on both sides. Look, I was there in Europe for a bunch of that didn't, the Americans didn't get very good treatment either from some of the Euro fans. It's just how out of hand you let it get. And it just got too much out of hand at Bethpage. Far
It's
too.
clear that something needs to be done to rally back the spirit of the event that was intended to be camaraderie and gentlemanly and with the ethos of golf. We're running short of time. We're talking with Hank Gola, ex-New York Daily News, but still phenomenal sports writer, author of Ryder Cup Rivals. Hank, tell us one last favorite Ryder Cup story of yours from the book that you think is the single most dramatic that we haven't talked about yet.
Oh, you're let me see. There are many of them. You're putting me on the spot, Jack.
Well, I've been a big fan of 91, to be honest with you. Talk about.
Oh, I Kiowa. Yeah, I mean, hey, look, all right. So, I mean, Kiowa was amazing because the golf course itself. The Ocean Course was basically made for the Ryder Cup. Pete Dye, the tournament was supposed to be held in California at PGA West, and for many reasons, they wanted to move it to the East Coast. And basically, Pete Dye was building a new golf course out of scratch and built it for the Ryder Cup at the Ocean Course. So it was really hard, and the conditions showed up at the last minute. I mean, they were playing, the practice rounds were played in great conditions, and all of a sudden the wind came and everything changed. It was just nip and tuck the whole way. And it came down to, of course, the longer Irwin match on 18. Longer missing the little shorty for the which would have won and of course lost. He missed the little putt on 18. Which is and it wasn't his fault. Because his caddy and Longer were looking at the putt, and they saw a spike mark.
Right.
Right? They saw a spike
Exactly.
mark, right? And
This is back in the day when you can't fix spike marks.
right. So they figured, well, what are we going to do? And they decided that he was just going to hit it a little firmer. He
Right.
was going to,
Hit it
right?
through it so that less
Right,
break.
and he went through the break, and that's lost the Ryder. If that spike mark wasn't there, the Euros would have won the Ryder Cup that year. And so it just tells you about the vagaries of golf. And I mean, we all, I mean, we,
And the
you
microscopic
know,
difference between all these guys at the top,
right,
infinitesimal, okay?
right.
The difference between professionals, and yet the gigantic chasm between them and the rest of us mere mortals, too.
But we face that same stuff. I mean, we face rubber the green all the time. That was basically rubber the green, right?
Yes.
So I mean, we all can experience that, which is probably what it really makes golf the greatest game. You talked about football. I love football. I can't wait for the Super Bowl. It's going to be a great game. But it, as far as games go, I mean, I don't run. The last time I ran an out pattern and caught a pass was, in my 30s. But I still play golf and I still
Was
come
that the
up.
Cenozoic or the Mesozoic era?
Yeah, it was back then. We used to have a
Before I let
giant.
you go, what's your call for the Super Bowl?
Okay. Seahawks.
By
I
do you have a
think
score?
32. 23.
I'm going to go Seahawks as well, 31-17.
Okay. Yeah, I think they've become a
Everybody.
much better team. I mean, they have edges in a lot of categories, and I think Darnold will play okay. He hasn't been turning the ball over lately, and that's basically the bit of difference in the game. Seahawks defense is so superior, and I think they're going to clamp down on Drake May, who hasn't had a very good playoffs to begin with. So that's
Hank
my
Gola,
outlook.
everybody. All right, thank you, Hank Gola, everybody. Jay Flemma here from Golf News Net on iHeartRadio and Jay Flemma Sports Report. We will see you in just a few minutes with the second half of the show.
You can get it on Amazon. Let me throw that in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Order the book on Amazon, Ryder Cup Rivals, the only book you need to read about the Ryder Cup from Hank Gola, the only guy you need to read besides Jay Flemma.
Yeah.
Take care.